This is Liner Note Leftovers, your weekly musical discovery hosted by 106.1 The Goat's resident crate digger, Dan Soul. Let's dive in.
All right, my lovelies, it is time for Liner Note Leftovers number 7. We are continuing our quest to get to more episodes than you can fit on one side of a 12-inch vinyl record, which technically you can fit as many as you want on there, but it'll get real scraggly and gross and the DJ will hate you, but don't look too far into the metaphor. Number 7 is a big number. It's lucky, if you will, and today we're doing something a little bit different. It's kind of just how the needle dropped this time, but this episode is called
Not Even Supposed to Be Here Today,
and it's entirely devoted to things that should not have been. We got a song that wasn't even supposed to see the light of day, an entire live album that wasn't even supposed to be a thing but saved a band's career, a lawsuit that wasn't supposed to happen because the defendant wasn't even involved with the rock and roll computer crime, not even knowing how to check her email, a rock star that shouldn't be at Elvis's house in the middle of the night. I mean, he broke in and jumped the fence, like, come on. And also, a man who should not have been a rock and roll manager, at least after he stabbed a guy and went to prison for it. But when you're legal defenses, the Allman Brothers drove me crazy. You can get away with a lot. There's so much to get into, so let's not waste another groove here. This is Liner Note Leftovers. Some of us have an easier time than others laying some smack on Canadian rock. Personally, I don't like to do it, but we do have to admit, the Guess Who's These Eyes is a very, very syrupy saccharine song. It's sugary sweet, which is weird when you really consider its origin story. The song These Eyes started out as a weird little parody about how annoyed Randy Bachman was with his date. So check this out. He's hanging out in the living room of Lorraine Stevens' parents. Now, Lorraine Stevenson was his date for the night and eventually became his wife. They had 6 kids together, and he's frustrated with how long she's taking to get ready. So he starts fiddling around on the piano and talking about how long she is taking, and he starts striking the D minor and C major chords in a very weird way. Not a way the piano players conventionally do it, but he's bringing a guitar player's sensibilities to it. Eventually, he starts to think that he's onto something, and he brings it to new Guess Who singer and songwriter Burton Cummings. Which awkward story about how Burton Cummings joined the band? Randy Bachman invites him to a Winnipeg radio station, says, hey, you want to join the band? And Burton Cummings thought he was joking. He's like, yeah, right, the Beatles want me to join too. Now, a few minutes later, he runs back into the radio station, says, wait, are you guys serious? And they say, why, did the Beatles call you in the meantime? So he's new to the band, they're looking for a hit, and luckily, Burton gives that inspiration, and it takes them about 15 minutes to write These Eyes. And Burton Cummings, as a trained Royal Conservatory of Music pianist, gives Randy Bachman credit for coming up for that innovative sound, which are from a form sense wrong, but in terms of sonic sound, are great. So they put this song together and decide they don't want to put it out. Why not, you might be asking? Well, they thought it was too saccharine sweet. They didn't want to lose their cred as a hard rock band. Well, hard rock for the 60s, you know what I mean. But RCA's like, no, this is what you got, we're putting it out. And that was a good thing, because it went to number 6 in the US. It was the biggest hit for the Guess Who so far. It spawned a whole bunch after that, including American Woman, No Time, No Sugar Tonight. And much like These Eyes, all of those songs are based on different experiences, like romantic troubles, or arguments in hotel lobbies, or getting in a beef with a trucking convoy. But those are stories for another time. Today, we look back on These Eyes, a song so syrupy sweet, it might be a hit.
These eyes cry every night for you. These arms long to hold you.
Let's be honest. All of us from time to time have pirated a song. Now, nobody has to say anything because yada yada, Fifth Amendment, you can't catch me in a crime if I don't say anything, which isn't a thing in Canada, but you know what I mean. But y'all understand what I'm saying when I talk about going on LimeWire, finding a surprise unreleased Nirvana song, downloading it for 6 days, nuking the entire family computer with 18 Trojan horses, and then it turns out it's Nickelback. We've been there. And it wasn't really treated like a crime until a Metallica song called I Disappear, which was supposed to be the theme song for Mission Impossible 2, got released to radio stations from Napster. Then the heat was on. they were getting sued. Every DVD came with an unskippable anti-piracy banner. You downloaded tracks off a CD, you got the songs, but also that along with it to make sure you weren't pirating. And of course, there was that classic ad, who can forget it?
Stealing a song is the exact same as stealing a television, jacking a car, or kicking your grandma down the stairs for her pension check.
Nobody ever got prosecuted for that, though, right? At worst, you got a strongly worded email from your internet provider, hey, you're being naughty. But surprisingly, lawsuits did happen. The Record Industry Association of America sued about 20,000 people during the heyday of music piracy. But the most famous was a mother of four named Patricia Santinalgo, which wrapped up on April 27th, 2009. Now, this had gone on for years, this lawsuit, and actually required two different trials because the first judge threw it out when they found that Patricia could barely even check her email. She had no idea how to use a computer. Turned out it was the kids all along who'd been using Kazaa to download songs. This thing ends up going so high profile that even before GoFundMe was a thing, people raised about $15,000 in order for Patricia and her family to defend themselves. For the family, it ended up costing about $24,000, and for the RIAA, countless amounts of money more. In the end, the association ended up getting about $7,000 out of the family. And you really gotta think about it, that's hilarious. 4 years worth of a lawsuit, countless amounts of man hours, lawyers' fees, and trees, a whole forest in the Midwest was cut down to make the Xeroxes for this case, I'd imagine. And in the end, it turns out when they studied music piracy, they found the people who pirated music ended up buying more in the long run. But don't let it get in the way of a cheap payday. Right now, it's one of the songs that probably started it all. It's Metallica, I Disappear. You know, it was the great rock poets AC/DC who once said, it's a long way to the top if you want to rock and roll. But perhaps nobody knows that better than Cheap Trick, who on April 28th, 1978, began recording a two-day show that would later become the Apodokin album. And at the time, Cheap Trick, in very, very dire straits. They'd already released three albums so far, and while they'd been met with masterpiece critic reviews, we all know that critic reviews do not pay the bills. There are more important things happening that will make you famous as a rock band, and none of them were happening for Cheap Trick. Album sales were middling at best, radio stations were not playing their tunes, and they were stuck as an opening act. They'd been going on grueling tours, opening for bands like Kansas, Santana, Kiss, and even Bebop Deluxe. And let me tell you, when you're not a big band, you're putting in a big chunk of change to go on tour. So Robin Zander says they were almost $1 million in debt by the time they decide to, on a fluke, listen to their record label and play a couple of shows in Japan, because Cheap Trick was getting surprisingly big in Japan. And there were also some eases on distribution for albums in Japan as well too, which would save the record label some money, but that's neither here nor there. When they landed in Japan and saw 5,000 fans on the tarmac waiting to meet them. Like, if you go and look at the pictures, it gives you a sense of Beatlemania, complete with, according to the band, fans trying to rip their clothes off, get autographs, some of them hanging on the side of taxis trying to take pictures. And on the 28th, they eventually arrive at the Budokan, which had previously hosted the Beatles, Led Zeppelin, Deep Purple. And the funniest part is Cheap Trick didn't even know that they were recording an album at the time. The Suits had called up and said, record it, we'll see if we can't make a live album out of this. And let me tell you, just by listening to that album, you can hear how hardened and how tight Cheap Trick is in their live shows, because they've been doing 300 nights a year. They were broke and hungry, so they were going all in on this one. But apparently, not all in enough for the band, because finally when it's revealed to them, hey, You know those two shows you played on April 28th and the 30th at Budokan? We recorded those. We're gonna make them into an album. Rick Nielsen says they hated how they sounded. They thought they sounded rusty. They thought it sounded hideous. But they eventually okay it. It starts getting distributed through the states, through radio stations, and actually by word of mouth a lot. A lot of fans were going up, hey, you heard this album? Check out Cheap Trick at Budokan. Check this out. And boom, like that, they had the biggest hit that they've ever had on their hands. In no small part with songs like I Want You to Want Me, which is way better on the live cut than it is the studio version. It eventually went quintuple platinum and is now sitting in the National Library of Congress for its musical achievement. The Foo Fighters, Weezer, Smashing Pumpkins, The Raccoon Tours, and a whole bunch of other bands have credited it as major inspiration. And that's pretty good for an album they didn't want to release at all, right? It's often been said that you should never meet your heroes. And that's true sometimes, but not all the time. But one thing that's always true is if you're gonna meet your heroes, never, ever, 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 ever run up on their lawn at 3 a.m. It doesn't matter how famous you are, you're probably gonna get thrown out by security. But nobody knows that better than Bruce Springsteen, who on April 29th, 1976, decided he was gonna break into Graceland. Okay, maybe not break in. Here's how the story went down. So Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band, they play a show in Memphis that night. It goes over really well, and Bruce Springsteen is one of the biggest acts in America at the time. So he knows he's in Memphis, he's got that walking spirit. So he says to fellow E Street Band member Steven Van Zandt, let's go jump over the fence at Graceland and see if we can't meet Elvis at 3 a.m. And holy man, you gotta get an idea of what these guys look like at the time. Bruce Springsteen was going through his peak long hair and scraggly beard look, and Steven Van Zandt just looked like young Silvio Dante before he played old Silvio Dante. Not the kind of guys you want running up on your house at 3 a.m. But they take a cab down to Graceland and say, all right, cabbie, wait here. So they take a little peek over the fence, notice the lights are on, and they jump and made it as far as the front door of Elvis's house before security members ended up intercepting him, which is alarming when you're the king of rock and roll. But Bruce Springsteen decides he's going to try and lay on the charm a lot here. He says, hey guys, don't worry about me. Have you seen me in Newsweek? Have you seen me in Time? I'm here to meet Elvis. I have a song for him. It's going to be a great idea. We're only here for tonight. Now, here's the problem. That light was on because one of Elvis's entourage was home, not Elvis himself. Elvis was in Lake Tahoe at the time, and even if he was home, was probably not gonna open the door for two guys who had jumped the wall and ran towards the door. Steven Van Zandt and Bruce Springsteen were escorted to the door, politely yet firmly, but at the end of the day, there was no bad blood. Bruce Springsteen released the song Fire, which was about the king, and also allegedly the song he had for Elvis that night, though the truth may have been a little embellished there. And if you look closely at the cover of Born to Run, which was Springsteen's biggest album at the time, you'll see a little button, and if you look very, very closely at it, it says Elvis the King, King's Court, Elvis Presley, Fan Club of New York City. It's hanging from the guitar strap in case you ever miss it. Oh, and how did Elvis feel about all this? Well, according to a friend of his, George G.K. Klein, Elvis was a fan. He liked Bruce Springsteen. He liked how he came on the scene hard and heavy, and that he was a total rock and roller. So that's gotta feel good knowing your hero said that about you. Let's take a little listen to that track, Bruce Springsteen's Fire, and see if you can picture it for Elvis, because I sure can.
I'm driving in my car, I turn on the radio, I'm pulling you close, you just say no, you say you don't like it, but girl, I know you're alive. 'Cause when we kiss on fire.
You know, every so often, I learn a story that I'd never heard before. And sometimes that gets real wild because this happened on April 30th, 1970, but it easily could have happened in 1870. It is some Wild West cowboy legend type stuff, but this is all true, I swear it. So 51 years ago, the Allman Brothers Band is playing a gig at the Buffalo Club, which is fittingly enough in Buffalo, New York. And the club's manager, a guy named Angelo Aliota, promises the band $1,000 for their two shows. And as was common practice at that time, Aliota tried to stiff the Allman Brothers. He says they were late on the first show and he was only going to give them $500 unless they played one more show the next day. Now the Allman Brothers were already pretty pissed off because they had just driven 600 miles from Long Island to Buffalo to play these shows, played two shows, and now they're going to be ripped off. So Barry Oakley, knowing that he's not going to be able to do anything, goes and gets his tour manager, a guy named Twiggs Linden Jr. And even before this incident here, Twiggs was a wild dude. He first started out managing Little Richard when he was 23 and fresh out of the Navy, and got a reputation as a man who had a decent fuse, but you set that fuse off, watch out. The dude was a fixer, so he gets up in no mood and storms out of his hotel with a 10-inch fishing knife bouncing at his hip. And this is an important detail because all of the Allman Brothers Band said, Twiggs, you best not take that thing with you. So Aliota gives Twiggs this story about, oh, well, we're late, do another show, I'll pay you more, yada, yada, yada. And that immediately devolved into a brawl that ended with, according to many people, Linden yelling, I don't care if I get the electric chair, I'm gonna prove a point. So very quickly, Aliota was dead and Twiggs was in jail facing life for murder. The Allman Brothers couldn't even stay and support them, though. They had a gig in Cleveland, and they were gonna be in more trouble if they missed that, but they make sure that Linden's got a good lawyer. They hire up a guy named John Condon Jr., who decides, all right, here's what we're gonna do. We're gonna plead insanity because of the rock and roll lifestyle. Between the partying, the late nights, and the amphetamines, they thought that this was gonna work. Temporary insanity caused by the Allman Brothers. In fact, during the trial, they even called in Barry Oakley as a narcotics expert, which basically just devolved into asking him when the last time he took amphetamine was, which was apparently an hour before the trial. Yikes. The craziest part of this, it worked. I'm not even kidding. Twiggs spent 18 months in jail before the trial and 6 months in a hospital. By 1972, he was back on the roads with the Allman Brothers Band, and in fact is credited with keeping them together after the tragic deaths of Dwayne Allman and Barry Oakley. Now this story does come to an end a little bit later in the 70s when he starts managing another band called Dixie Dregs, and as they're headed up to a gig in Syracuse, Linden decides to go skydiving, and let's just say he got a very nice view of the Catskills before his parachute didn't open. I'm serious, man. This is like the tragedy behind a Western song, but it is the true story of Twiggs Linden. And what song could quite give that vibe, quite like a little Midnight Rider? I'm serious, man. The story of Twiggs Linden still gives me chills since I heard it. There were a whole lot of great stories we heard today. I mean, Cheap Tricks at Bodokin, not supposed to be a thing. Ditto for the Guess Who's These Eyes. We heard about Bruce Springsteen breaking into Elvis's house. So again, you can meet your heroes, but don't sneak up on their lawn at 3 a.m. And of course, one of rock and roll's most infamous lawsuits, and that's saying something. And speaking of stories, I had a thought while I was chatting with a fan named Jim, and we were bouncing back and forth about the secret pair of panties that you can find on the Alice Cooper School's Out cover, and whether or not the do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do of Baba O'Reilly is timed out to heart monitors. And I got thinking, if you ever have a story you want to hear on Liner Note Leftovers, hit me up with it. I love hearing about your rock and roll knowledge, because when we share in this stuff, it's so much more fun. The music community, it's as large as the universe itself. It's one of two scientific constants. Actually, science nerds, don't come at me about that. I have no understanding of that. I'm gonna just keep to my records. And if you got a liner note you want me to talk about, always give me a shout. Drop me an email, danielmsoul@gmail.com, or at the social media of my day job, @1061thegoat, on your favorite social media platform. You might be featured on Liner Note Leftovers. And while you're out and about, don't forget to rate us wherever you listen to your podcasts, because it means a whole bunch for the show. Allows me to keep on keeping doing this. And speaking of keeping on keeping on, I'll see you guys again for Liner Note Leftovers Episode 8 next week. And remember, always grab life and your vinyl by the edges.
That's a wrap on this week's episode. For more musical discoveries with Dan Soul, head to MyLloydMinsterNow.com or subscribe to Liner Note Leftovers wherever you get your podcast fix.